It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Universities of Wisconsin leaders plan to shutter another branch campus, this time in Menasha, in the east central part of the state, citing steep enrollment declines and the inability to generate enough tuition to cover costs.
Last week, UW-Oshkosh announced that it would be closing its Fox Cities campus a year from now. Here's UW-Oshkosh Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs Ed Martini at a news conference.
There was simply no scenario that we could explore, and we believe we did a thorough analysis to get to that point that was going to result in a sustainable campus for the future.
The Fox Cities campus joins five other branch campuses that UW officials have closed or have announced plans to close since last year. Corrine Hess is WPR's education reporter with us to talk about how these two-year campus closures are affecting students, faculty, and the surrounding communities. Corrie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So the UW system has had 13 two-year branch campuses. Can you walk us through this wave of downsizing and closure?
Yes, this all started about 2 years ago with these campuses just seeing a complete downsize of enrollment. And that's when, you know, UW System President Jay Rothman decided that something had to be done and these closures began.
Can you walk us through which of the six communities are affected in Wisconsin?
Sure, yes. So right now, you know, we're talking about Fox Cities in Menasha, but there have been several. So UW-Platteville's Richland Center campus was the first to announce it would end in-person instruction in November 2022. That school officially closed last year. In addition, there have been two UW-Oshkosh branch campus closures, and then UW-Milwaukee ended classes at its branch campuses in Washington County last month. It will end classes in Waukesha next year. UW-Green Bay has ended in-person instruction in Marionette. Also, you know, like today we're talking about UW-Oshkosh, so they will be closing Fox Cities next year, and just this month, they've closed its Fond du Lac campus.
So how have currently enrolled students at Fox Cities and other of these closed campuses or to be closed, how has that affected, you know, how have the students being affected by the shutdown?
Well, the students are able to go to a nearby four-year campus, but they are affected because a lot of times these students choose these two-year campuses because they cost less, they're closer, and they're just smaller, which a lot of times these students are looking for a smaller campus to go to, either because they're right out of high school, obviously, and they want something smaller and closer to home, or they're returning students. They're a little bit older. They're juggling families and full-time jobs, and this is just a better fit for them.
And you talked with a former student, Bethany Gengler, a 2018 grad of the Fox Cities campus, and she talked about that attending a small two-year school like Fox Cities made it easier to transition into college, and then she also expressed concerns for future students.
For new students, it's going to limit their ability to attend a UW school. It's going to require more resources, more traveling, more gas in order to get this degree, as well as additional tuition.
Will these closures limit a student's access to higher ed?
I think it will. Oshkosh Chancellor Andrew Levitt estimated about 70% of the students from the Fond du Lac campus will go to UW-Oshkosh. But in talking to students, I think they're really worried about this. They like the smaller campus, the less expensive campus, and the closer to home feel. So I do think that it is limiting for some students, yes.
Would these students have to travel greater distances to continue their college coursework?
In some cases, yes. I mean, it depends on where they live, but in some cases they will.
What might happen to the branch campus faculty in these closures?
Well, again, UW System President Jay Rothman has said many of the faculty can move to the main campus. I haven't confirmed if they do move, but there's an issue of staff members who don't teach. So you know, it wouldn't make sense for them to transfer because their roles are duplicative. So they would, you know, lose their jobs.
So they, and that could be happening in the months and weeks leading up to the full closure of these campuses. What about campus buildings and facilities? Did the UW officials talk about the infrastructure itself?
Well, in a lot of cases, you know, these schools are major employers in a community, and these buildings take up a lot of space. They're a lot of times county owned, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, they are county owned. There was a bill recently signed into law that will give communities that have a branch campus up to $2 million to redevelop. So that was just passed in the spring. So there has been some focus on what happens to these buildings in the communities.
You also talked with, I think it was Outagamie County's executive, Tom Nelson, responding to the news of the Fox Cities closure. What was that sentiment like?
Tom Nelson's really upset about this. He feels like he was not given enough notice and that this was done in secret. He says that, you know, both Chancellor Leavitt and System President Rothman were given the benefit of a strong education system, and that people that want that now are being limited because of these branch closures.
We're talking with WPR education reporter Corey Hess about multiple two-year UW campuses being marked for closure in the last couple of years, what it means for higher education around Wisconsin. Corey, you mentioned these steep declines in enrollment blamed in part for these closures. Why are two-year campuses experiencing major enrollment drops?
You know, it's not just the two-year campuses, although they've seen the largest decline in enrollment drops. I just think that fewer people are deciding to go on to college. There's also just been a struggle. College is expensive, and there's concern about affordability. And then schools and, you know, both the two-year and the four-year in this state are struggling because state budget, the funding has remained flat. So, you know, I think the UW system is struggling as well. It's been a difficult time for the UW system, but also for the private colleges. We've seen just, you know, El Verno College in Milwaukee just declared last week that it's not financially viable. So this has been, it's not just the two-year schools, it's all across the board with colleges right now.
Walk us back some years. It's 2017, 2018, and the UW system, you know, went through with this consolidation, removing two-year colleges from like a standalone subsystem, merging them with their nearby four-year school. What are the effects of this reorganization? What are you hearing?
Well, I think what the effects have shown is that it's been hard on the two-year colleges, and but that's been coupled with just the idea of students just not going to college as much as they had been.
And UW Oshkosh, as you mentioned, four-year colleges have struggled to, you know, with their budgets. We've seen Oshkosh go through cuts, facing a budget deficit. Will the closure of the branch campuses, you know, strengthen the financial position of the four-year universities?
I think that's what the hope is, that these students will then transfer and go to UW Oshkosh. So that will strengthen the four-year school. I guess time will tell on that.
We also heard Governor Evers recently seeking to ask the legislature to give the UW hundreds of millions of dollars in the next budget proposal. Could, like, an infusion in funding or a potential funding boost help alleviate these financial pressures that are currently felt by the, you know, remaining two-year campuses?
I think it could help. I'm not sure that Governor Evers' proposal to give the UW system more money will be met. Mm-hmm. will go with it. I'm not sure what the legislature will do with that.
Sure, sure. In the meantime, what are you watching for in these affected communities, as well as the remaining two-year campuses that stay open?
Well, I think that it will be interesting to see what happens with this new law that was just signed to give the communities the $2 million to redevelop these buildings. You know, this was the sixth two-year campus to be announced at Fox Cities for closure. There are still, I believe, seven more two-year branch campuses. So I'm not sure, you know, what will happen with the remaining seven. And UW System President has said he isn't entertaining the idea of closing any four-year campuses, but several of them are also struggling. So I think it's something to watch to see what happens with the four-year campuses moving forward.
Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Hess is WPR's education reporter, giving us an update there on the recent closure announcement of the UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus and how the shutdown of multiple two-year UW campuses has affected higher education in Wisconsin.
Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Today. You're tuned into the new WPR News lineup. We are glad you're here.
And thanks to listener support, WPR delivers trusted coverage and context. You hear from reporters, writers, and cultural figures who enlighten, who inspire, and connect.
Our June member drive is coming up on the 27th of this month. You can help fund the WPR coverage you rely on right now. Get an early start. Because when 500 donors give before the drive starts, a group of generous members will add an extra $10,000. Join in with your gift of any amount at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate.
Contribute to WPR now so that everyone in Wisconsin has access to high-quality journalism and meaningful conversations. Help us meet this goal for you and for all of Wisconsin.
Join in now. Make that gift at WPR.org/donate, and thank you. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Wisconsin sociologist makes the case that women are the social safety net of our country and feel pressured to make family caregiving the top priority.
I think in addition to guilt, we're often encouraged to kind of judge and blame each other.
We explore the new book called Holding It Together. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin and the U.S. do not have the same social safety net policies as other high-income countries, and that shifts more of the responsibility on the individual to overcome personal hardships.
Sociologist Jessica Calarco says this system is a disadvantage to women in particular. Her new book offers detailed accounts from new mothers who are scraping by and lays out our society relies on women a lot to keep the economy running.
Calarco is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Her research team followed families for 4 years and conducted national surveys involving thousands of parents. The book is called Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Jessica, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the book, you describe our country as being a DIY society, a do-it-yourself society, everyone expected to solve their own problems, their own hardships. What does that look like from the framework of how we go about our lives in this country?
Sure. So essentially, other countries have invested in social safety nets to help people manage risk. They use taxes and regulations, especially on wealthy people and corporations, to protect people from falling into poverty, give people a leg up in reaching economic opportunities, and really ensure that everyone has the time and energy and incentive to contribute to a shared project of care, to take care of their families, their homes, themselves, their communities. In the U.S., we've instead tried to DIY society. You know, we keep taxes low, we keep our social safety nets net is as threadbare as possible. And we tell people that if they just make good choices, they shouldn't really need that safety net at all. And the problem there is that you can't actually DIY society. Forcing people to manage all that risk on their own has really just left families and communities kind of teetering on the edge of collapse. And at the same time, we haven't collapsed in part because we have women kind of holding it together, filling in the gaps both in our economy, filling the kinds of low-wage jobs that are often difficult to fill for employers, and also filling in gaps in the safety net, you know, doing the default caregiving for children and for the sick and for the elderly in our communities.
What's remarkable about the book is we go deeply into the lives of some of the people you and your research team interviewed, like Akari, who is managing, you know, three part-time jobs after her partner killed by gun violence, and stringing all of these jobs together and then doing jobs in manufacturing on the weekend. What is it like for a woman like Akari to try to patchwork together multiple jobs?
Sure. And certainly this is not an easy situation for her. She talked about how, I mean, she went from being a stay-at-home mom to having to work three jobs to make ends meet for her family. And the irony is that it wasn't even that she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom in the first place. She was pushed into it because, you know, when her children were born, she and her partner earned too much to qualify for any childcare subsidies, but not enough to afford to pay for childcare. And because her income was lower than her partner's, it made more sense to sacrifice her paid work. And so, like most stay-at-home moms in the U.S., she was kind of forced into filling this role, filling this gap in the childcare system. And then when her partner was kind of suddenly and tragically killed, she had to figure out, you know, how do I keep a roof over my kids' heads? She didn't have a job, didn't have access to substantial savings. And she talked about how, you know, kind of going from one job to another, just to try to make ends meet, it added to emotional stress that her family was facing in the wake of her partner's death. She talked about how her daughter had PTSD in part from her father's death, and also from the fact that in her mind, she lost both of her parents, that she went from having, you know, a stay-at-home mom who was there all the time to almost never getting to see her kids or getting to see her mom because, you know, they barely had any time together between the almost 60 hours a week that Akari was working just to be able to keep a roof over their heads.
The red flag here was that her hours were capped, that employers kept her hours lower. What did that allow them to circumvent?
Sure. So the way that the Affordable Care Act works in the U.S. is that employers are incentivized to both push workers into part-time roles that don't hit that sort of cap, that don't have requirements attached to them to provide health insurance for their employees, and also to keep workers as contractors rather than kind of official or official employees with on their books. And so what that meant was that many of the kinds of jobs that Akari was able to find when she started looking for paid work, and she actually needed to find paid work to be able to qualify for welfare payments because we have work requirements, the jobs were often very low wage, very part-time jobs in retail that simply didn't pay enough to make ends meet. And so kind of running up against those caps made it incredibly difficult for her to find not only jobs that would pay her substantial incomes or offer opportunities to move up, but also jobs that would offer any sort of benefits, things like health insurance that she needed for her family as well.
You mentioned work requirements, and in safety net programs and here in Wisconsin, ensuring that people who are on these types of welfare programs are also earning and having a job. How does that work out? Does that lead to better employment?
It usually doesn't. Unfortunately, the research on that front shows that these kinds of work requirements typically operate to funnel low-income, especially low-income women, disproportionately women of color, into the kinds of low-wage jobs that employers struggle to fill, that this doesn't lead to long-term stable employment or to the kinds of jobs that offer opportunities for real growth or for real savings over time. And that's in part because, and at the same time, women often get stuck in these jobs even after they run out of eligibility for welfare. In Wisconsin, for example, you can only be on welfare for 2 years at a time and only 5 years over the course of your lifetime. And so that means that many women, you know, end up struggling and stuck in these kinds of jobs because they're the best options available to them, particularly when they're also trying to rely on things like welfare.
Another story is Brooke. And Brooke gets recruited to work at her child's daycare, which means free daycare, but Brooke working at minimum wage. And the salary was like $25,000. Can you talk about that catch of women wanting to work and yet childcare is the thing that holds them back, the barrier.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the kinds of childcare subsidies that we have available for families are often only available to very low-income families in our communities. And they're also not available to, you know, things like college students who might want to continue their education while being able to, you know, have their children in childcare. And that's essentially what happened to Brooke. She actually didn't want to have children herself. She'd grown up in a very kind of difficult home life. And yet, like many young women, she ended up getting unintentionally pregnant in college. And she initially planned to get an abortion, but her mom talked her out of it, said, we'll help you, you know, we'll help you care for the baby and we'll help you stay in college. But ultimately, they figured out that they couldn't afford to pay for both college and for childcare. And so Brooke ended up, you know, dropping out of college and having going on welfare and trying to find the first job that she could. And, you know, she started in a retail job, but that, you know, paid very little money and was incredibly stressful. And she ended up taking a job in childcare because this was, she talked about how at the time childcare was costing her almost as much as rent, even with the subsidies that she qualified for. And so this was, you know, not the job that she envisioned for herself. She did like it. But even when she got promoted to assistant director of the center, she was even then still only making $25,000 a year and didn't have access to employment benefits, in part because, you know, small businesses are also exempt from things like the ACA requirements and from things like even unpaid leave requirements for things like family and medical leave. And so this was, you know, difficult for Brooke in the sense that she wanted to go back to college, wanted to have access to those opportunities, but couldn't find a way to make childcare work for herself in ways that she could, you know, not only keep a roof over her family's head, but also be able to invest in the kinds of opportunities she wanted long term.
We're talking with UW-Madison sociologist Jessica Calarco about her new book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Jessica, you look at countries, Scandinavian countries, where there are these robust social support systems. Do you think that we can take those programs and make them work here in our country based on the economy we have now?
Yes, I think we have strong evidence to suggest that these kinds of safety net programs could work here. I mean, we have examples like Social Security and Medicare, which, you know, yes, have not been funded maybe to the level that they need to be, but show that it's possible for us to do large scale social safety net programs that are incredibly successful at lifting people out of poverty, improving health outcomes, and kind of operating at a broad scale level. And even, you know, during World War II, we put in place a large scale childcare program to help raise women's employment when we had large numbers of men off fighting in battle. And it was highly effective at increasing workforce participation rates among women and helping to provide high quality care for, you know, children across the U.S. And so it's certainly possible to do those kinds of, to put in place those kinds of changes here. And we actually got fairly close with Build Back Better. We had policies, and even during the pandemic, we, you know, dramatically cut the rate of child poverty in the U.S. through things like the child tax credits. And many of the families that I talked to, things like the student loan moratoriums or rent relief programs during the pandemic, or even the COVID stimulus payments, made a huge difference for many of these families. And so these programs are possible and feasible, and we have the resources to do so. Those resources are often just consolidated in the wrong hands.
One of the stats, and you have many numbers and statistics in the book, but more than 70% of U.S. adults believe that hard work alone, not luck or help from other people, determines who gets ahead in our society. How does that mentality affect what you see in the safety net?
Sure. So I talk about this as sort of the meritocracy myth. And many people in the U.S., in part because of the kinds of cultural messages that have been promoted in our society for decades, have come to believe that we don't really need a social safety net, because if people just work hard enough and have the right mindset, they'll be able to succeed no matter what kinds of challenges that they face. And you know, this has been promoted by lots of different, everything from business groups to think tanks to kind of politicians in our society. And it's a sticky idea, because in the context of high levels of inequality, like what we have in the U.S., it's psychologically reassuring to believe that if you just work hard enough, you'll be able to be successful. But one of the problems that comes with this kind of attitude is that it leads even people who would benefit from a stronger social safety net to decide, you know what, maybe we shouldn't have that net, because that allows them to have a sense of moral superiority over people who are a little bit worse off than they are. And I talk about a mom who I call April, who's a white evangelical Christian mom who she's a stay-at-home mom, and they get by on about $30,000 a year from her husband's income as a pastor at their church. And yet April says, you know, she opposes things like universal childcare, universal health care, raising the minimum wage, paid family leave in part, and talking, kind of digging in and asking her where this sort of opposition comes from. She judged other families, and especially other women who rely on these kinds of government programs, implying that if families need to rely on those programs, it must be because they're making, you know, bad financial choices. And then she often even drew on sort of racist and sexist stereotypes, saying those moms must be going out and getting their nails done or going out and partying and hiring babysitters. And at the same time, so essentially by rejecting the need for a social safety net and by buying into this idea that hard work and good choices alone can guarantee success, April allowed herself to sort of feel better, to feel a sense of superiority, even though that meant denying herself the kind of social safety net that her family arguably needs and also deserves.
Jessica, how do you see the role of organized labor factoring in here? How having a right to work laws like those in Wisconsin affect the landscape for women and the work life and what they can earn?
Sure. So we know that unions, labor unions, are one of the strongest tools that we have in our arsenal to help protect workers and ensure that people not only have access to the kinds of financial resources that they need to avoid precarity and have opportunities for their families, but also to make sure that they have access to the time and energy that they need to participate in, you know, the shared project of unpaid caregiving labor. You know, we can outsource some parts of our care work, but we can't outsource everything. We'll always need to care for loved ones around us and spend time with them and, you know, care for our homes. And I'm guilty of having a giant pile of unfolded laundry, you know, that needs to be put away, and I just don't have the time to do it. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that labor unions can not only fight for better paid benefits, but also for time, to ensure that workers have the time and energy to be able to contribute to their communities and to their families. And certainly the kinds of laws that we've seen not only in Wisconsin, but in many other states that have tried to chip away at union bargaining to limit the power of unions have operated to dramatically increase inequality in those kinds of states and make it harder for workers to bargain not only for better wages and better benefits, but also for the kinds of time protections that they need to be contributing more actively at home.
You end the book saying, imagine a world where we value care work on par with IT. What would that world look like to you?
Sure. So, and I use that example in part because I talk about a couple in the book where, you know, before they had kids, she was a social worker and he was working in IT, and she was making, despite having a higher level of education than he did, only $30,000 a year, and he was making 90. And so what that meant for them as a couple was that when it came time to make decisions about who would sacrifice their paid work to be the default parent, for example, when they had kids, it almost seemed like a no-brainer to them that she would be the one to sacrifice her paid work to care for the kids or to fill in the gaps when the pandemic hit, for example. And so I use IT as an example there, not because it's, you know, not valuable work, but because it's often, you know, valued so much more than the kinds of caregiving jobs that disproportionately fall to women, where IT work is disproportionately done by men. And so in practice, what that would mean if we were to value that kind of caregiving labor, we would treat it, we would recognize that that kind of caregiving labor is often underpaid because it doesn't work well with our sort of profit-driven kind of free market economy, in the sense that things like social work, it's almost all labor, and it's work that is needed by people who don't have the resources to be able to pay for it themselves. And so essentially that means that, you know, if we're going to make that work viable, we have to invest in it as a public good. And that means higher government investments of tax dollars in services from social work to education to childcare to healthcare, to make that kind of work not only viable for the people who do it, but also funded to the level where it's high quality care for the people who need it in our society. So that's, you know, one big piece of the equation is valuing care work in ways that make that work sustainable and high quality, and also putting in place protections where people can participate in the unpaid caregiving labor as well, having, you know, limits on paid work hours, ensuring that people have protected, you know, paid time off and protections on that front to be able to have more time with their families, have more time to volunteer in their communities, to help on those sort of more informal parts of the caregiving equation as well.
One more thing with that pile of laundry that is unfolded, mine mound on the mound as well. you know, you could have offered self-help tips here to women. You could have given your insights on how you can be scrappy and pull this together. Why didn't you go that direction?
I mean, I think it's important. I see the role of sociology in particular, and as a sociologist, as sort of ungaslighting people, to help them to recognize that the kinds of challenges that they face in their lives are often the product of social structures and social forces that are so big that they're hard to see from an individual vantage point. And so my goal with this book is sort of to help people to see those structures in ways that can help them to avoid, and particularly women, to help avoid blaming themselves when they struggle and to let go of some of that guilt, but also to push women, especially through kind of seeing the kinds of stories that are in the book, to not only recognize themselves in those stories, but to better see other people. I think in addition to guilt, we're often encouraged to kind of judge and blame each other. And my hope is that through a book like this one, people will be able to better understand why people are struggling, even if their circumstances are very different from their own, and also to recognize how in those shared struggles are opportunities for connection. And that we can start to reject some of the myths, things like the myth of meritocracy, that are designed not only to delude us into believing that we don't need a social safety net, but also to divide us by race and class and gender and politics and religion in ways that try to prevent us from coming together to demand a better social safety net, you know, rather than just trying to do what we can to maximize our own individual success or the success of our kids often as well.
Jessica, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lovely conversation.
Jessica Calarco is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison, and she was with us today to share her new book. It's called Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, communities around the state are set to take part in a global music celebration, including an art center on Madeline Island.
We're going to kick it off with our kazoo and instrumental band riding the ferry across to Bayfield.
A preview of Make Music Day coming up on WPR News.
It's a worldwide celebration, a musical dedication for the nation. Let's make music, 608, let's do this. On the 21st, we moving, grooving. Longest day of the year, sun's out, no clouds in the sky, is clear. Fresh gear, a quick look in the mirror, let's go. Y'all ready to move, let's go.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret, and that is Make Music Madison's Anthem, written and performed by Madison artist Corey Whitmore.
The anthem celebrates the world's largest annual music event, Make Music Day, taking place this Friday across the globe.
Organizers say musicians will perform in 120 countries and more than 1,000 cities. That includes about 24 communities here in Wisconsin.
We're visiting two of those communities now for a look at their local Make Music festivities.
Peggy Ross is the board chair of the LaPointe Center for the Arts, a nonprofit organization that supports the arts on Madeline Island. And Nick Damasis is the founder of Nick and Friends, a Beloit-based band. I talked with them last week and asked Nick what brought him back for a second year of Make Music Beloit.
Yeah, well, last year was the first year that Beloit participated in it. And I don't know if you know this, but they're Wisconsin has more cities participating than any other state in the country. So Beloit jumped in last year, and it's just a great spontaneous community based event, and it's just great to see people getting out there, regardless of their talent or non-talent, and just making some music. So it's hard to not want to participate in that. And then last year was such a success that we were not hesitant to jump back in.
And Peggy, I understand LaPointe is joining for the first time this year in Make Music. What made you and others there want to bring Make Music onto Madeline Island?
Well, you know, there are a lot of talented musicians and talented artists of all kinds on Madeline Island. And we saw this through Create Wisconsin, and we thought, gosh, why aren't we doing this? This is a great place. We have pop-up concerts throughout the summer and free concerts. And it's like, why not? People love music here on Madeline Island. So we're really excited to be a part this year and hoping to grow on it next year.
Nick, tell us a little bit about your band, Nick and Friends. You're playing originals, but this is kind of very much in the spirit of make music. You've got kind of a rotating group of songwriters and musicians who come in and out. Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, and that gets back to your first question, too, of why we wanted to be a part of it. It really is the spirit of the Make Music Day is also the spirit of our band. And so it was a few years back in the 1990s, if you can remember that far back. I was doing a little singer-songwriter thing in Minneapolis where I grew up. And then, of course, you get married, have a child, buy a house, and, on with the career. So it kind of tucked that away. But as down here in Beloit, and as I was talking to other musicians that would be playing, and I'd say, hey, do original songs? And they're like, yeah, but nobody really wants to hear the originals. They want to hear cover songs. So I heard that enough times that I just said, all right, that's it. I'm gonna start a group, and people can come and go as they want, but we have a hard and fast rule that it's only originals. Once they hear the first the opening of Brown Eyed Girl, people they start dancing, and then they start requesting other songs. So we thought we're going to have to limit it, only give them so much of a choice. And that's all of our originals. And so we've been doing that for 2 years now, and people coming and going just as they're able. And so that's why it's Nick and Friends, so that it can be, as you said, a rotating cast of characters. And it's fun because it's gaining momentum, and it's the community spirit of it has really caught on, and I think it's kind of its hallmark.
Peggy, can you talk us through what's going to happen on Friday on Make Music Day in La Pointe?
Yeah, we're really excited about it. The ferry is a special part of Madeline Island, getting our people to and from the island, of course. So we're going to kick it off with our kazoo and instrumental band riding the ferry across to Bayfield and coming on back to the island. And they're going to then do a little march down parade to the Bell Street Tavern area, where we've got the street closed off for the day, and the La Pointe Center for the Arts stage mobile is going to be set up, and that's going to be the center of the action for the day. We've got, local performers, we've got kids coming in, we've got people, who are professional with their bands and, amateurs. But probably the unique thing about the island is people just come when you announce it. And so we've got some open mic pop-up times. And every day we're getting people saying, hey, I'm going to come. I'm not sure what time, but we're going to be there. And that's just kind of the spirit and the fun of the island. People just all of a sudden like to gather and share and relax and enjoy the time.
And Nick, I know in your non-musician life, you're a library director there and concerned a lot with building community around Beloit. Can you talk about how an event like Make Music can kind of help, build that sense of place and bring people together in a community?
Yeah, and Beloit is, it's 36,000 people. It's still it's a community that you can put your arms around. Different from a Madison or a Milwaukee. So having a downtown center where we're able to, as Peggy said, put up some stages around town and ask and have people come out. We have a farmer's market that's the second largest in the state of Wisconsin. So a lot of things going on here in Beloit and a very vibrant downtown. And as you said, with the library, always just trying to connect community and communities and getting people really out there and getting to know each other. And something like this, Make Music Day, it's not a talent show. As Peggy said, there's a lot of talent in all of our communities, but it's really about people just coming out and making noise, getting out there, inner musician, banging pots, stand on the front step if your neighbors will allow it, and just feeling good and coming together that way. So an event like this, I think, is important. And I think the connection across the country, across the state, across the country, and the fact that it's international also adds kind of a connection of a larger community as well.
We are talking about Make Music Day coming up. It's a worldwide event. Wisconsin well represented with stuff going on in about 24 communities. We're hearing from two of them. Peggy Ross is with us, board chair of the LaPointe Center for the Arts on Madeline Island. Nick Damasis is the founder of Nick and Friends. He's representing Beloit with us today. And Nick, yeah, let's make music day. We're previewing it. We better have some music, right? I guess you've got a song for us that you're planning to play at Make Music Beloit.
I'm a renegade with an attitude. I'm a hand grenade full of platitudes. Live hard, die young, drive fast, take chances every time. It's a long, strange trip we've been on. Life ain't a highway, it's an autobahn. And I've never been too good at staying between the lines. Come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive. Come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive.
And this, of course, we had planned where Peggy was going to play a drum solo right here. But paintbrushes on canvas just didn't come through on the mic. So I'll just do one more verse then.
Adam and Eve screwed up the garden. What's wrong if we burn a little carbon? I've been good for so long, I don't know if I'm dead or alive. Hit the gas, sit the world on its axis. You drop the clutch, I'm a bit out of practice. No one will catch us, not even the cops will try. Come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive. Come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive. Everyone, come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive.
Oops, tried to hit the harmony.
Come on, baby, get in the car, let's drive.
Beep, beep, honk, honk.
All right, yeah. All right, and so you're going to have that, the whole band doing that, or is that just going to be you singer-songwritering tomorrow?
No. The whole band does it, and like you said, with harmonies, we got some really good, I'm the weak link in the group, even though I put my name up front. So the smart thing, of course, to do is surround yourself with really good musicians and singers. And so so that's what we do. It's a good time.
And Peggy, if I'm hearing you right, Make Music is not the only day to hear music in LaPointe. We can, especially during the summer, I imagine, go out and check out some music there too, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The LaPointe Center of the Arts, we sponsor free concert series on Thursday evenings. And 6 to 8 out on the stage mobile at the rec center in town. It's free. We've got brats and beer and soda that's always there and available. And it's a great time for, people to just come back, relax, and enjoy the musical talents that we can bring. And so LaPointe Center is always, proud to have that. And we'd like to continue to expand it because every year there's more and more people that talk about it and come on out. And then of course, During the week, the restaurants have bands coming in. Tom's Burndown always has a band. The Beach Club oftentimes does. Now that LeSueur Street Cafe, Marty's always bringing in some bands and during brunch too. So it's a great many opportunities that happen in the summertime here with music.
Nick, part of the point of Make Music Day is it's supposed to be free, all the performances. And I know some musicians are like, we're trying to make a living here. Why are we having all this stuff where we're giving it away for free? What do you think of that?
I've heard that before. And I think everyone's got to, of course, make the decision for themselves about how they're willing to share their talents. But on a day like Make Music Day, to me, that kind of just washes away. It's just it's a day for everyone to be able to enjoy music and let it out in that. And the idea of monetizing every single note that we play just doesn't, some people can do that. Also, as I said at the very beginning, we do original music and there's not as much of a high paying market for that. So obviously I'm biased on that. We play whenever, whenever we can in that. And we're just having a good time doing that. And I think that's what Make Music Day is all about. And there's plenty of opportunities throughout the year to, you know, to put a price on what you're selling or the audience to say, I want to go and see that level of talent as well.
Peggy, this is the first time around for Make Music in La Pointe. If somebody is out there listening in a community that hasn't done Make Music and thinking, why aren't we doing this? What would you suggest to them to get it rolling for next year?
You know, at first when we saw the opportunity or, you know, to discover what Make Music Day was, we're like, whoa, you know, this seems pretty big. Can we really handle and do something like this? And in, you know, in talking with Ann Katz from Create Wisconsin, she was so helpful. And, you know, she encouraged us and said, hey, Peggy, La Pointe, Madeleine Island is perfect for this. You know, you don't have to do anything big. And so I, you know, just reached out to the public art committee in town, the church in town, some community volunteers. And, you know, we've just come together and said, you know, let's keep it simple. We have so many talented people in here that love to play music. The kids love to sing. You know, let's just try it. Keep it simple and they will come. So that's what we're hoping for. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate, you know, no matter, you know, larger communities can, like Milwaukee and Madison, you know, they've got a bigger pool of resources, but anybody can do it. And the support that Ann Katz and Create Wisconsin has provided us and the and at the national level as well as the state level, it's really no pressure to make it this elaborate thing. You know, take the talents and opportunities that you have within your own community, and it's fun. We're really excited, and you know, we've already got it marked on our calendar for next year.
And Nick, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, oh, I haven't pulled out the guitar or kazoo or whatever in a while, and I could go out and play in front of people, I don't know, maybe I'm a little shy, give some encouragement for them to go out and share those musical gifts.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that I hear most about when we play and that when I'm in the audience, it's that the people up there are just having a good time. They're smiling, there's camaraderie, and that can, you know, people forgive a world of musical sins if you look like you're just having a good time. So I would say do that. Bust open that sax, you know, case or guitar case or whatever and just show up. And, you know, you can also get together with a couple people and work something out if you felt that was what you wanted to do. If you try too hard, that's when you might get discouraged and start to get nervous. Just get out there and do it.
We'll leave it there. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
And Peggy, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Peggy Ross is the board chair of the La Pointe Center for the Arts, a nonprofit organization that supports the arts on Madeleine Island. And Nick Damasis is the founder of Nick and Friends, a Beloit-based band. Hey, are you planning to make music in the big event coming up on Friday? Let us know about it. You can send us an email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Maybe we can plug your performance between now and then. We are going to go out with the big top singers performing Madeleine Island's national anthem. It's called Over to Old La Pointe. This is Wisconsin Today.
Village in the shade of an old fruit tree, then a new farm summer resort. Once you visit Madeleine, you come to know her well. She'll tell you tales of Nebraska roll and the vaudeville and El Marvo. And the wind sled over the ice we go to Madeleine. Over to Old La Pointe, rowing to Old La Pointe. Summer is here, we'll have our share.
As the UW system is in the process of downsizing its branch campuses around the state, we want to hear how these closures of two-year campuses are affecting your community, how they're affecting your family.
Have you attended a two-year campus? What was that experience like? Would you have gone to a four-year campus if you didn't have the option of a branch campus near where you live?
Tell us about your circumstances and what these closures mean to you. Leave us a message. You can also text us right now at 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can text us as well.
Big Wisconsin story in the headlines. We want to hear how it affects you. Call in at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.